I'm Alan Cockle, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Cuban and American officials continue their standoff over Christmas decorations outside the U.S. Embassy in Havana. Along with Santa Claus and the usual flashing lights, the embassy display includes a large neon sign with the number 75, a reference to 75 Cuban dissidents jailed by the Castro government. Cuba has responded with its own display outside the U.S. embassy, including the word fascists and images of Iraqis in Abu Ghraib prison. Meanwhile, a more serious dispute over trade has erupted between the two countries. Since 2000, a U.S. law allows limited exports of agricultural products to Cuba, provided payment is made by cash in advance. Cuba's an increasingly important market for U.S. farmers, but a change in the interpretation of the rules a few weeks ago now threatens that trade. Kirby Jones is the president of Washington-based Alamar Associates, which facilitates U.S.-Cuba trade. Hello, Mr. Jones.
Thanks a lot. Nice to be here.
You're representing farm groups who are exporting to Cuba. How important is trade with Cuba today?
Well, it's very important to certain sectors. For example, for the rice industry, Cuba represents the third largest market for American rice. It's the eighth largest market for poultry. And Cuba is now about the 22nd largest market in the world for U.S. agricultural products.
Now, let me see if I've got this straight. Beginning a few weeks ago, companies that sell food and agricultural products to Cuba found that their payments weren't being credited to their bank accounts. Cuba was putting up the money, but they weren't getting the payments.
That's correct. The money was frozen once it arrived in the United States. For 3 years, American companies had adhered with the law, which called for payment in advance, which in the customary manner of trade means payment before the purchaser receives title to the goods. And that worked for 3 years. And all of a sudden, without notice, certain banks were holding payments to American companies that had arrived from Cuba.
So until a few weeks ago, if I was selling a shipload of corn to Cuba, the ship would be loaded. At some point, Cuba would get a bill of lading, a list of contents of the ship. They'd pay for it.
Exactly.
So someone stateside is now insisting on payment when?
Someone in stateside thought of redefining the words pay in advance to mean pay in advance of shipping. And this was based on their feeling that because there may have been delays of days in the payment, was Cuba receiving backdoor credit? Since the extension of credit by U.S. companies and U.S. institutions is not allowed by the law, payments were held pending that analysis.
Well, that's reasonable, isn't it? Whatever the intent of this legislation was, it was certainly not to extend credit to Cuba.
Absolutely. And no single company has extended credit to Cuba.
You're a go-between between U.S. exporters and Cuban buyers. Who do you think is behind this crackdown?
Well, it's hard to say. There are people within the administration who look at every opportunity to stop any trade, any travel, any relations between the U.S. and Cuba. And this is one step which some people seized on as a way to administratively stop trade which had been legalized by Congress and the previous president.
Now, we did speak to the Treasury Department. They wouldn't join us on tape today, but they said, we have not changed the way we're interpreting this rule. We're looking at it. We haven't changed anything.
That's just not true.
Mr. Jones, Cuba's only 90 miles off the coast of Florida. What difference does it make if the payment is made before the ship leaves port or after it gets to Cuba?
If payments are demanded before the ship leaves port, that means that once the seller receives its money, that product in the ship becomes property of the Cuban government in U.S. territory and is subject to seizure by those who have claims against the Cuban government. So from the purchaser's point of view, in this case Cuba, they could have their money frozen and the product frozen. So it's a terrible risk for them.
Mr. Jones, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Kirby Jones is the president of Alamar Associates. He joined us from Washington, D.C. Tis the season, and across this land, in church pageants and snowy front yards, a familiar tableau is arranged. The infant Jesus in his cradle, Mary and Joseph gazing on adoringly, There are shepherds and kings, and as often as not, an ox and an ass. But how much of the familiar nativity scene comes from the Gospels, and how much is from other traditions that have been added later? Ben Witherington is a New Testament professor at Asbury Theological Seminary in Lexington, Kentucky. Welcome, Professor.
I'm glad to be with you.
Let's begin with the birth of Jesus in a stable, a story that every Christian and surely many others have heard is no room at the inn.
Right.
But give us your historian's perspective here.
Well, the Greek sentence in question in the Gospel of Luke reads literally that they laid the baby in a manger because there was no room in the kataluma. Now, the Greek word kataluma has two possible meanings, one of which is guest room, and the other of which is inn. Several factors involved here. First of all, Bethlehem was a wide place in the road. It wasn't even a one-stoplight town. There's no evidence that there was a wayside inn, much less a Holiday Inn, in Bethlehem. So from a historian's point of view, it's unlikely that the word means that here. And in fact, in the only other place where this Greek word occurs in Luke's gospel, in the story of the Last Supper, when Jesus asks that they go prepare a room for them to hold the Passover meal in, it's this word, and it means a guest room. So I'm saying, and many scholars would say, that what the text of Luke actually says is they placed the child in the area of the house where the animals were kept and where the manger was because there was no room in the guest room. So this whole tableau of them being cast out by the secular world, the innkeeper at the inn, and ending up in some barn somewhere is not even what Luke himself likely said.
Well, give us your best guess. What were conditions like in the guest room 2,000 years ago?
The archaeology has been done, and we've looked at these first-century Jewish houses. And what we know about these houses is these are houses with maybe three or four rooms. And then in the back of the house, there would be a partition or a wall, and behind the wall, you would keep your most precious beast or beasts of burden. And you'd bring them in because you wouldn't want them stolen during the night. And that might involve a ox or, you know, a donkey.
But the ox and the donkey that we see in paintings and in the nativity scenes, they don't actually appear in the Gospels.
No, they are not mentioned. What is mentioned, of course, is shepherds and sheep. But what we're not told is that there are any sheep near the manger where Jesus is. So actually, there are no animals mentioned on the site in the location where Jesus, Mary, and Joseph actually were.
Well, how did that ox get in there then?
Well, it comes actually from St. Francis, who loved many things and all kinds of creatures, great and small. He actually is the first one to have set up a nativity tableau. And he brought the animals into the thing, and was, as was the tradition in the Middle Ages, you would try to combine the story of the shepherds with the story of the wise men, which is in two separate Gospels, and so you have both shepherds, and you have wise men, and you have animals, and you have the Holy Family all in one fell swoop.
Was St. Francis making a sort of political point by bringing the ox and the ass in?
Well, you know, that's a good question, but you need to remember that the ox, for example, was a symbol of one of the Gospels. It was the symbol of the Gospel of Luke. And so, I mean, he may have done it for that reason.
What else is in our modern nativity scene that isn't precisely in the Gospels?
Well, here's another little interesting tidbit. The Gospel of Matthew is the only one who mentions the sages or astrologers. Nothing said about them being three. What's said is that they gave three gifts. Now, you could have six people giving three gifts. You could have two people giving three gifts. All we know is that they are wise men, if you will, sages who look at the stars and try to figure out what's going to happen. Nothing said about them being kings either. That was a guess, again, in early Christian history, on the basis of the fact that they had some pretty snazzy gifts.
Right. Give us some historical context here. Luke describes Joseph and Mary arriving in Bethlehem. They're engaged but not married, and Mary is already pregnant, of course.
Right.
How scandalous was that in a first century Jewish society?
Very much so. This is an honor and shame culture. It was expected that every good Jewish girl would be a virgin when she went in to the betrothal contract. And betrothal contracts were as binding in those days as marriage contracts are today. So it was very much a very serious matter. So much so that it might fall under the stipulations of where a young girl would be stoned. Now, you need to understand that it's an arranged marriage. This is not something that Joseph and Mary themselves cooked up. It was their parents arranging this for them. So for them to dissolve this relationship after their parents had made it, I mean, that's a huge scandal and potentially life-threatening to Mary.
These Gospels of Matthew and Luke were written sometime after the life of Jesus.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Most of the scholarly realm would say that they were written somewhere between, say, about 70 A.D. and 90 A.D.
And there are stories going back almost 2,000 years saying, hey, there is funny business going on here. This was an illegitimate pregnancy.
Right. And so when the Gospels actually tell this story, from my point of view, there has to have been something like this that actually happened to Mary, because you wouldn't make up a story like this about your founding father and mother, so to speak, because it's a scandal if it involves illegitimacy. So what I would say about this story is it's too improbable not to be true, because the earliest Christians wouldn't have made up a story about this that would be subject to so much scrutiny and doubt by skeptics.
So you're taking it as a literal truth.
Right.
But there are parallels to the story of the birth of Jesus in, for instance, contemporary accounts of the birth of Caesar Augusta, right? I'm getting this from the esteemed biblical journal Newsweek magazine.
Well, you see, and that's absolutely not correct. What you can say is, in the story of Caesar Augustus or the birth of Alexander the Great or any of those prominent figures, we do have stories where a pagan god was believed to have come down and mated with a woman. But those stories are very different from this one. We don't have a god coming down. There's no act of mating. It's just a miracle that takes place in Mary's womb, which has no precedent in any earlier Jewish literature and no direct parallel in the Greco-Roman literature.
So the story of this birth appears in only two of the four Gospels. Were they written for different audiences, do you think?
Very different audiences. The Gospel of Matthew was written for a Jewish Christian audience, probably in Galilee, but somewhere that the sort of gestalt and ethos was very Jewish. Luke is writing to a man by the name of Theophilus, who was probably his patron, and who didn't know any of this stuff. So he has to have it explained to him in terms of Jewish customs and all that sort of stuff. So Luke writes like a good Hellenistic historian. So, yes, two different stories for two very different audiences.
And nothing in there anywhere about a little drummer boy.
No little drummer boy, and no partridges in a pear tree.
Professor Ben Witherington from the Asbury Theological Seminary in Lexington, Kentucky. Thank you.
You are most welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Alan Cockle. It's Here and Now. The Bible is the most translated book in history. Ever since the early church overcame its resistance to seeing its sacred text appear in everyday language, evangelists have worked tirelessly to make it available to anyone who can read. But according to our next guest, of the 6,000 languages in the world, the Bible has only been translated into about 400, which is why Miriam Ronning and her husband founded the Home for Bible Translators and Scholars in Jerusalem. The school teaches scholars, primarily from Africa, how to translate the Old Testament directly from the original Hebrew into their native tongues. She joins us in the studio. Welcome, Miriam.
It's a joy to be here.
It's good to have you here. Your school has students translating from Hebrew, not from English. Why go back and translate from Hebrew instead of from English or French, which is a common tongue of many people in Africa?
Because there is a big difference if you translate from the original or if you translate from a translation. Having a photocopy of a photocopy.
Right. Can you give me an example where you would lose something by going from English instead of...
Well, we had one time a student from India who has grown up close to Himalayas. And he was very disappointed about Mount Zion. I mean, mountain has to be in the height of one of those big mountains in Himalayas. And he says, oh, Mount Zion is a small hill for me. Or another example, the word valley in the Hebrew language has different words for valley, and the word valley for the wonderful Psalm 23, even though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, the word there in Hebrew means ravine. Now, if you're walking in a ravine and you have shadows and fearful, you know, animals there, it's much more frightening than open valley. Mm. That is, you can see miles ahead, miles, you know. So there are differences. Some of the difference we do not even know. Because if somebody translates from original and then to his mother tongue, there is a powerful contact there, and he leaves all of us in the West out of it. The best translator is the one who knows the original, and he translates into his own mother tongue. That's the best translator.
And now students come to your school to get a special grounding in original, in this case Hebrew, but they're spending 6 months there. Is that sort of crash course enough to make them fully competent translators?
First of all, they are all translators. Secondly, they come with biblical Hebrew, introduction to biblical Hebrew. And that way they are already have the first stage. And yes, it's a crash course. But we don't give them just the language, we give also the land. Figures of speech, what does it mean, you know, the grapes and the different fruits and animals and features of the land, which all are part of any language, really. So they do get not just language, but they also get the land of the Bible and all its images and figures of speech.
Well, let's bring into the conversation now Dr. Uche Aharon, a recent graduate of the Bible Translation School. He's a linguist and a citizen of Nigeria. He joins us today from Jerusalem. Welcome, Uche.
Yes, thank you very much.
What languages are you translating into?
In Nigeria alone, there are actually 505 different languages. Each one of these languages has several dialects of its own.
Of these 505 languages in Nigeria, how many would the Bible still not be available in?
Let me put it this way. How many do have the Bible? That is the big question.
How many?
We have only 17 languages that have the Bible. 17 out of the 505 have the whole Bible, and 47 of them have just the New Testament.
It must be a daunting task to start translating the Bible for the first time into a new language, especially because probably some of these languages don't even have a written version. Is that right?
Very good. That's where linguists like myself come in. We go into a language, we live among the people, we learn the language, we analyze it, draw up a writing system, an orthography, and then write up materials, you know, to teach the people to be able to read and write. And then out of these, we pick up the best ones, and we train them further to do both translation and literacy work in the language.
And what happens when you come to, say, an animal that existed or exists in the Middle East but not in sub-Saharan Africa? Is that a problem for a translator?
Yes, it is a problem for translators. You know, there are two ways in which animals and trees and, you know, landmarks, geographical features are brought into the Bible. One way is that they are actually historical items. Like when you talk about the River Jordan, for example, the River Jordan is physical. It is different from something like to say, I will make you as white as snow, where they are not really referring to snow as a part of a historical plot.
So you're saying in this case, snow is just a metaphor, so you don't have to translate snow for Africans.
That's right.
Right. Yes. Are there spiritual concepts that are difficult to translate?
Yes, this is where what Miria was saying is very relevant. You know, the culture of Old Testament with their sacrificial systems and things like that, they are very similar to many African cultures. But those things are really not the same in Western cultures. So when they are talking about ritual objects and beings like spirits and so on, we have a feel for how these things can be transferred into our own language.
Right. Well, yes. I'd love to have you read something for us in honor of the season.
Perhaps you would read Luke 2, verse 10 and 11. And the angel said unto them, "Fear not, I bring good tidings of great joy."
Yes, I will. I'm reading from the Obolo language. Ire ogosra ya bebama ika trupo mizira tete eyo oboro nyo tutu ene wongwon enene kese izrenyi. Chireke memra make David memra gunyanga inyenyi. Ogunyanga yi ire Christ okane.
Thank you.
Yes.
Ucha Aron is a linguist at the Home for Bible Translators and Scholars in Jerusalem, and Miriam Ronning is the co-founder of the school. Thank you both for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to remind you that if it wasn't for translators, even the English language wouldn't have this season.
Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Alan Cockle, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. U.S. military officials are re-examining security at bases in Iraq today, while also defending the measures they had in place before Tuesday's deadly explosion in Mosul. A suicide bomber is now suspected in the attack. At a briefing yesterday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said it's difficult for U.S. forces to prevent every attack.
They have to be right 100% of the time. An attacker only has to be right occasionally.
Joining us on the line is Kalev Sepp, retired Special Forces colonel now at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He returned 2 weeks ago from Baghdad. Hello, Professor Sepp.
Hello, Alan.
Does it surprise you that an Iraqi suicide bomber could get inside a U.S. base?
It's not surprising, given the maturity of the insurgency at this point.
Could the U.S. be doing a better job of preventing these things?
It would be very difficult to do that. The scale of the U.S. occupation in Iraq is such that the size of the bases requires that they hire Iraqi nationals to work on the bases doing various jobs, most of it manual labor. But without it, they've either got to turn more troops that are doing combat duty into support units.
And what do you mean the maturity of the insurgency?
It's been 21 months since the invasion, and there's a very widespread agreement now that proper counterinsurgency measures haven't been put into place until very recently that these things have been considered. This has allowed the anti-coalition and mostly anti-American resistance to become organized to the point that they can begin to carry out these kind of attacks like that occurred at Camp Meretz.
21 months into this situation, proper counterinsurgency techniques are not in place?
This is one of the key issues in the nature of this war. General Casey had asked just a few months ago who his counterinsurgency expert was on his staff. General Casey is the commander of the multinational force Iraq, and the answer was that he didn't have one.
He didn't have one.
That was the response from the staff. The intelligence chief had indicated that he should be considered the counterinsurgency expert, but he has other than his intelligence background, has no particular experience in these operations.
And this, we understand, is why you were called to Iraq.
It was as a number of other subject matter experts have been. But yes, that's why I was called.
Well, give us a sense of what kinds of security holes you saw when you were, for instance, in the Green Zone and in the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad.
I wouldn't call them security holes, but there's security is problematic. With the collapse of the Iraqi government, there is no Iraqi government infrastructure to do the kind of security checks that would be necessary to vet everybody that would be working inside the international zone, as an example, or on coalition military bases.
Was there any sense inside the U.S. Embassy that there had been infiltration even inside that building?
Yes. The newly arrived personnel received security briefings. On the one hand, I want to say this is normal because all U.S. embassies are considered targets for espionage. But it was made very clear that that it was understood that among the Iraqi nationals who had been hired to work inside the international zone and even inside the embassy building proper, that there were infiltrators among the Iraqi nationals.
And are these infiltrators doing it to earn a few bucks, or are they hardcore insurgents?
You have to understand how an insurgency operates. There are combatants, and that tends to be the smallest number. They're specifically trained in combat operations. But then there's a larger number of auxiliaries that don't carry weapons, but carry out these very important intelligence gathering operations. And it would be sort of in that ring of insurgents that would be conducting attempts to infiltrate bases and key facilities in the international zone.
Can you give me an example of a specific kind of thing that you saw that concerned you?
A number of people noticed inside the international zone that some of the laborers that would be out in the street sweeping or had received passes to come and go from the international zone as convoys would come or go from the embassy area, that these people would open their cell phones unaccountably and make a brief call. It seemed it would seem obvious that they were reporting on the convoy movements.
So every move out of the Green Zone is reported?
Certainly out of the Green Zone. The point would be is that it occurs inside the Green Zone as well.
Today's Washington Post tells of what it calls, quote, a virtual intelligence meltdown in the city of Samarra. It says because Iraqis and U.S. troops have so much mistrust now between them. Can this mistrust ever be turned around?
I want to say on a theoretical basis, yes, it can. One of the indicators of the reach of terror inside the embassy, excepting the rocketing that occurred almost daily and that came into the international zone, was that the barber shop in the embassy had been closed for several weeks. When I asked about what the problem, it was commonly understood that the barbers had been threatened, and their families had been threatened by insurgents with their lives if they continued to work in the embassy.
So, what was done about that?
Nothing that I was aware of. Things have deteriorated to a point that it's made intelligence gathering difficult, depending on the area inside Iraq. Some areas are very very settled and relationships are good. Others they're very fractious between the Iraqi nationals and the coalition, and then even inside that, and even within the Iraqi nationals, there are different groups that have different kinds of relations with the Americans. Most simply, speaking of Sunnis and Shias and the Kurds, but the recovery from this is possible, but it will take a long time.
Kalev Sepp is a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Professor Sepp, thank you.
Thank you, Alan.
Still to come, we take a listen to an unusual radio station broadcasting from an assisted living center in Cincinnati, Ohio. You're listening to Here and Now. At least three U.S. Marines were killed in action today in Iraq's Anbar province, where the restive city of Fallujah is. U.S. officials have called last month's offensive in Fallujah a success, but today fighter jets are again dropping bombs on the city. The action has disrupted the return of some Fallujah residents. Only a few hundred managed to inspect their homes, and many said they did not want to live in the city anymore. We spoke yesterday with two Marines who were on their way back to Fallujah. They talked about their work and about what they'll be doing on Christmas. We reached them through Military Public Affairs in Baghdad. First, 24-year-old Corporal Michael Garrett of the 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines Alpha Company, based out of Hawaii. He is an infantry squad leader doing house-to-house searches in Fallujah.
Walking through the streets is indescribable, the feeling. There's always that chance that the insurgents are still out there. But we handle ourselves well. We take care of ourselves. Basically, the city itself is rubble between artillery and air attacks and mortars. So there ain't too much of the city left. To be honest with you, I'm not too scared. As far as the Marines on the left and right of me, that's the biggest thing. I have total confidence, and I trust them with everything I have. And so all in all, no, I'm not scared. We know our jobs. We trust each other, and that's all I can ask for. And as far as Christmas, from what I have understood, we're going to be getting a hot meal, a big meal. From what I understand, I believe they're going to be bringing it out to us. And my Christmas present to me is being able to see my daughter. I have a daughter that I haven't been able to see. She was born in September. And it was good news to hear. I'll be taking off middle of January, and that's going to get me through the rest of the time that I spend inside of the city. I love what I do. I love everybody at home. I'll be home soon.
My name's Corporal Gonzalez Vladimir. I'm with 1st Marine Headquarters Group, Multi-Transport Unit. I'm 25 years old. I'll be 26 next month in January. I've been here for now 3 months. Basically, the past couple of days, we've been doing convoys, do a lot of convoys, supply routes, supply bases. And, you know, I mean, it's risky, but, you know, we have a 50% chance of getting hit every time we go on a convoy, so kind of get used to it after a while, you know. Dealing with it is just, I would say, I'd call it second nature. I don't really think about it too much, you know. Try not to have too much on my mind. We take it day by day here. I should be rotating out early next year soon, before I come back again. You miss your family a lot when you're over here, so, I mean, you receive your orders and you just follow through with it. But eager to do it? No. I'm not sure what I'll be doing on Christmas once I get back to Fallujah. Probably I'll be on a convoy or something, you know. I'm not really sure yet. To my family, I like to let them all know that I miss them a lot. They're always on my mind. Every day, every minute. And to all the people out there, I'd just like to say thank you for all the support they've done for us and given us. You know, everything we do out here is for you all.
Five-year-old Corporal Vladimir Gonzalez is with the 1st Marine Headquarters Group Transport Unit. He has family in Miami, and he's been driving convoys in and out of Fallujah. Earlier, we heard from 24-year-old Michael Garrett. He's with the 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines Alpha Company in Hawaii. He grew up in Toledo, Ohio, and he's an infantry squad leader doing house-to-house searches in Fallujah. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Alan Cockle. It's Here and Now.
WMKV presents The Song Shop with Ann Wagner, live from
Here and
the
Now
Corbett
is a production
Studios
of WBUR Boston, but
now,
you want to know a kind of
Annie.
Guilty secret? Lately, I've been listening to another station, and not an NPR station either. WMKV, which you're hearing now, originates from Maple Knoll Village in Cincinnati, Ohio. It is, as far as we know, the country's only FM station broadcasting out of a seniors' assisted living center.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Best of the Song Shop. This is Annie Wagner, going to bring some great music to you this afternoon.
And Annie Wagner joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Alan. It's nice to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. How did you get started in radio?
Well, we had a wonderful station here. It's kind of a sister station called WVXU. At that time in 1980, I decided that I wanted to go to college and try to be on that radio station. I was 50 at the time, and I did. I registered for college as a freshman, of course. I had never been to school, and I got on that station over there when it was student-run.
Well, I don't want to be indelicate here, but I've been doing the math as we speak, and you're a little bit past the usual age for a DJ. Is that fair to say?
I'm 75, so I think that is a little bit past that. But at our station, that's the norm.
What do you like about being on the radio?
Oh, I was saying to someone the other day, I don't know what it is. Maybe I learned it in communication classes. The teacher said, when you're behind the microphone, pretend you're talking to just one person. Don't say, oh, it's like a whole bunch of people listening. One person. I've always had that thought in my mind. And when I get behind a microphone, I simply feel at home. I just love it.
Well, maybe you learned it in college, but you're also part of the generation that really grew up with radio.
Oh, we did. I used to sneak the radio into my bed late at night when I was a teenager to try to get those remotes, you know, that come from live from the top of the Statler Hotel here in downtown New York. And you think, oh, glamorous that would be, and listen to those big bands like Harry James and Glenn Miller, hardly able to get the signal in on a little radio. But I thought, gee, I wish I were up there. Charlie Spivak and his big, beautiful trumpet sound, and the lovely ballad, Count Every Star. We also heard Glenn Miller.
Well, let's bring someone else in here. Alan Bayowski is WMKV's general manager. Hi, Alan.
Hello, Alan. How are you doing?
Very well. How many listeners do you have?
Well, let's see. When you take a look at our signal here in the Cincinnati area, we reach about 30,000 people with our FM signal. And then when you go out onto the Internet, last month we peaked at right around 60,000 unique listeners.
Who are these people? Mostly older people?
Our primary audience here in the Cincinnati area would skew towards, I'd say, around 65, 70. But on the Internet, the people that we're hearing from on the Internet that check in and email us, a lot of them are younger. I'm surprised at the people 20 to 30 that are really enjoying this music and finding out that the lyrics, you can understand it. It's fun to sing to. And it's just uplifting music.
You make me feel so young. You make me feel so spring has sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual.
We received an email, I think about maybe a month or two ago, from a little girl named Debbie. And she said she was 18 years old and had just discovered our station. And she said, the music is just awesome. So she told some of her friends about, which I thought was very brave. Can you imagine being in high school and saying, hey, listen, I found this great station here, honey, and, you know, tune in to the music from the swing era. And she said, one of her friends said, it is the bomb. And I showed Alan, and I said, wait a minute, is this good or bad? I don't know. But we checked with one of our younger, I checked with my granddaughter, actually said, oh, no, Annie, that's good. That's a compliment. So we are the bomb.
They all laughed at Rockefeller Center. Now they're fighting to get in. They all laughed at Whitney and his cotton gin.
Ellen, what do you think the station brings to the immediate community at Maple Knoll Village?
We bring that great music that they grew up with, that music that brings back the memories. And we also combine with it information, Alan. We try to give that kind of information that, you know, lets them know about Social Security benefits or information that will help them in possibly a role as a caregiver. Also health-related information. We've even got a program called Grandparenting Today.
I want you to tell me about another program, Ernie Waite's Thought for the Day. But first, let's hear from Ernie.
Hi, this is Ernie Waite with the WMKV Inspirational Thought of the Day. Today, our thought is about the practice of forgiveness. Isn't it true that almost all of us would like others to forgive us? But you know, there are times when almost everybody we know is unwilling to forgive somebody else. Forgiving those who are
persecuted. Ernie is a gentleman that was very, very active with the station from day one when we went on the air 10 years ago. And Ernie just passed away in November. But Ernie brings to the station just this wonderful feeling of wisdom, this wonderful feeling of here's your grandfather who's lived a life, who's fought a lot of battles, and has survived. Ernie is the first African-American broadcaster in the greater Cincinnati area. He knew how to fight the battles, to make the difference. And his family, following his death, has given us permission to continue to air his thoughts for the day. And so the spirit of Ernie will continue on with us for many, many years.
He told me a story once. He was applying for a job trying to break that color barrier in Cincinnati radio, and it was such an uphill battle. And one of the people he was interviewing with said, Mr. Waite, it's going to be 200 years before you get a job in radio. And you know what Ernie said? That's going to be the fastest 200 years you ever saw. And he made it come true and made it happen. He was just, we miss him so much, but we do have his words.
Forgive, and ye shall be forgiven. Trust that truth. It's as certain as you sow, so shall you reap. This is Ernie Waite's.
Annie Wagner, would you take us out today with a song? And since it's Christmas, would you take us out, DJ us a Christmas song?
Next up, you're going to be hearing one of the most beautiful versions of a tune called Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. Many, many people have recorded it, but this version is by Judy Garland, as she sang it in the movie Meet Me in St. Louis back in the 40s. Have yourself a merry little Christmas, and that goes for everyone.
Annie Wagner and Alan Bayowski are from WMKV in Cincinnati and the Maple Knoll Retirement Home. You can link to their station from our website, here-now.org. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alan.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Alan Cockle. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
Happy golden days of your faithful friends who were dear to us will be near to us once more.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.